This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, hello everybody. How lovely to see you all. My name's Heidi Pritchard and I'm the Manager of Community Outreach here at the National Museum of Australia. Before we start, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of our land. I acknowledge the land on which we meet. I acknowledge their ancestors, past and their vibrant ongoing culture, which is actually a really nice way to start talking about interfaith and cultural awareness. This is the first in our lecture series for the So That You Might Know Each Other exhibition. And in putting together this exhibition lecture series, we consulted really widely with the Islamic community. When this exhibition was first discussed at the museum, it didn't make a great deal of sense to us on paper. We were asking, why does the Vatican have this incredible collection of objects of Islamic faith in their collection? And it wasn't until we understood the term, So That You Might Know Each Other, that the exhibition suddenly came into a really sharp focus for us. Suddenly we actually understood. And in putting together this series of program and events, we've tried to embrace the concept of interfaith and cross-cultural understanding. And it's really important at this time, right now, in who we are in Australia, with the way we're communicating, this is an important conversation for us to have. And that has been the underpinning feature of all of the lectures in this series. Now, from the very start, when we first started going out into the community, Mohammed and Fatullah from the Blue Star Intercultural Centre were there with us. They were answering our questions and they were being incredibly generous with their time and their knowledge. For someone like me who hasn't been raised in the Islamic faith, I know you find that hard to believe looking at me, it's been an exceptional opportunity to learn and explore the beauty of this fascinating culture. I know that I've had so many of my, what I didn't even realise were beliefs, I've had so many of them questioned, and it's been so exciting to constantly bump up to the preconceptions I have and find out I'm wrong. Now, the Blue Star Intercultural Centre is a community-based non-profit organisation that was formed in 2006 by a group of Canberrans who wanted to find out more about people from other faith and cultural backgrounds. Its ultimate goal is to establish a sound relationship with the many and varied groups of people in contemporary multicultural Australia. Their main activities are interfaith, so concentrating on the elements that unite people of faith. Intercultural activities, so celebrating diversity, and social awareness activities that aim to make people aware of the issues that are important to the various cultural and faith communities of Canberra and Australia. So please join me in welcoming Mohammed Askew and Dylan Esteban from the Blue Star Intercultural Centre to discuss more about So That You Might Know Each Other.
Beautiful. Thank you all so much for coming. Firstly, I would like to begin by thanking the traditional custodians of the land, both past and present, and extend a very warm hand of thank you to all the hands and minds involved in organising this event and making this exposition possible. To begin, firstly, I will be following my following presentation will trace the origins of the phrase "so you might come to know one another" to the 49th chapter of the Holy Quran. In doing so, I will begin with a brief discussion contextualizing the chapter and verse in question, and then I will be turning more attention to an in-depth analysis of the verse itself and what we can, as a contemporary people, glean from this particular passage. Finally, I will finish by providing some anecdotes of the early Muslims' interactions with their non-Muslim counterparts, which continue to serve as exemplary attitudes to contemporary Muslims today. When observing the title of the present exposition, one may naturally ask, where does this title come from? Where does this phrase actually come from? To the surprise of some, the statement's origin is the 49th chapter and verse 13 of the Holy Quran. While widely referred to as the chapter of the private apartments, in reference to the apartments or chambers of the Prophet's wives, it is also commonly referred to by many commentators as the chapter of etiquettes or good morals. This is due to the nature and content of the chapter itself. Now, Muslim scholars are in agreement that this chapter was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad in the late Medinan period, most likely following the conquest of Mecca, which was a period where much of the Arabian Peninsula was now under the Prophet's direct control. Consequently, as Sayyid Hussein Nasr notes, this chapter addresses the complexities of ruling over a larger and more diverse community and instructs more recent members in proper conduct towards the Prophet. Indeed, Amin Islahi, a very late but well-respected 20th century Qurani exegete from the subcontinent, he likewise situates this particular chapter in the same context. Islahi states, "This surah or this chapter was revealed in circumstances when certain things emanated from converts that showed that they were neither fully aware of the status or position of the Prophet, nor aware of their responsibilities in an Islamic society. Consequently, such directives were necessary for the circumstances of those times, and they were revealed as a supplementary chapter. All of these directives relate to the mutual rights of the Prophet and the Muslim community." So as we can see, the circumstances necessitated proper decorum to be reiterated and established amongst the faithful, hence the timing of this particular chapter. Our immediate concern, however, is with the 13th verse of this chapter, which reads as follows, and we can see it at the bottom of your screens right now. "O mankind, we have created you out of a single male and a single female, that you may come to know one another. Verily, the noblest of you in the sight of God is the most the righteous of you. Indeed, God is all aware, well informed." So firstly, I want to draw your attention to something that many of the Quranic commentators have noted when studying these particular passages. If we look at the verses which precede 13, we notice that there is a specific address in the first three of the four verses, all commencing with the statement, "O you who believe," in the plural. In doing so, the growing community under the tutelage of Muhammad are specifically addressed prior to a general address concerning humanity itself. Now, many commentators have noted that the transition from the specific to the universal is because the previous three verses seek to foster a sense of brotherhood amongst the newly acquainted and growing body of people, and as such, calls on people to be cautious of how they interact with one another in order to avoid any ill feelings festering, which, while initially may be private affairs between two individuals, can carry spillover effects into the family and public sphere, if not properly and if not adequately addressed. The last verse, however, draws our attention to something more universal, the issue of racial superiority. In contrast to immediate social interactions, the issue of racial superiority is something that is not only had permeated pre-Islamic Arabian society, but it is an ailment that is found universally wherever human beings reside. And hence the specific address from the believers to the address of mankind turns our attention to a universal ill or a universal disease that we are still coming to terms with in our day and age. So regarding verse 13 itself, one of the most famous commentaries called Tafsir al-Jalalain, it tells us that the word shu'ub in Arabic, which refers to nations, is the broadest category of lineage, and that tribes or qabail are a subset or a smaller portion of those individuals or peoples. They further state that the verb to know one another, ta'arafu, along with the preposition li, to acquire, means actually to acquire knowledge of the customs of one another, and serves as an exhortation to not boast over one's lineage. All peoples, in fact, stand equally before God. By adding the preposition here to the beginning of the verb to know one another, it indicates that the function of being made into distinct nations and tribes is for the very purpose of knowing and recognizing humanity for what it is, diverse and different. On this point, many ancient and modern Muslim intellectuals, including Fethullah Gulen and T.J. Winters, have noted that the diversity in creation reflects, in fact, the diversity in God's names and attributes. In essence, this world is, as T.J. Winters once described, a theater for the enactment of the divine names. Consequently, human diversity is to be appreciated and adored as an expression of God's action of creation, and not employed as a means of subjugating or depreciating one's fellow human beings. In this respect, coming to know one another is also coming to know God through his divine names and attributes, which move, shape, and shake the very fabric of reality and existence. So when looking at this particular verse, most commentators were concerned with the moral implications of it, and in their commentary spilt much ink detailing how antithetical racism was to Islam. Consequently, the main source of intrigue for the medieval Muslim scholar was in fact the statement, "The noblest of you in the sight of God is the most righteous of you." Since in a single statement it uprooted any considerations of race as legitimate markers of social standing and turned our attention to moral excellence. Now, the English rendition of Atqakum, or the most righteous of you, does not quite capture the entire expression that the richness of the Arabic language affords. The word used in the original, taqwa, originates and is derived from a word meaning parrying or to protect, perhaps indicative of protecting oneself from vice or sin, wrong actions, reprehensible character, or the displeasure of one's Lord. Often mistranslated as fear, this word here must be appropriately conceived in a much broader sense, one which incorporates a concern for all the issues raised in the previous verses mentioned, and importantly, a recognition that racial differences are merely products of circumstance and are not markers of physical, spiritual, moral, or intellectual superiority. The Quran does not call Muslims to insulate themselves, but as we have learned, human diversity is something that is to be discovered, explored, appreciated, and importantly, to be known. Such an endeavor is impossible without basic interaction and face-to-face dialogue. Indeed, the Quran exhorts Muslims to enter into dialogue with their non-Muslim counterparts in 3:64, in order to come to a common word between us and you. Again in 16:1-5, stating, "Invite unto the way of your Lord with wisdom and goodly exhortation, and reason with them in the best and most gracious of manners." We shall now look at how the early Muslim community dealt with such diversity in human experiences, and how particular episodes were addressed by the Prophet Muhammad himself, whom the Islamic tradition describes as the walking embodiment of the Holy Quran. In the Prophet's hometown in Mecca, Arab tribalism and in the Prophet's home city of Mecca, Arab tribalism, sentiments, and racial superiority of Arabs over non-Arabs was rife. This was particularly pronounced among the Prophet's own tribe, the Quraysh, who not only believed that the Arabs were inherently superior to other racial groups, but they themselves regarded themselves as the cream of the crop, the very pinnacle of, I suppose, existence in that regard. So in regards to this specific issue that was homegrown in the Prophet's own town in Mecca, the Prophet directly addressed this himself, and he confronted this attitude with quite some force. In his farewell sermon, it is reported that amongst many things the Prophet had said, some of which were, no Arab is superior to a non-Arab, and no white person is superior to a black person. Moreover, when once asked about Arab tribalism, he simply stated, "Leave it. It is rotten. It is rotten." Practically speaking, however, what was the prophetic example of dealing with racial differences between members of a newly found community? For one, Muhammad appointed a former black Abyssinian slave called Bilal as the caller to prayer. Now, in a society that was such, many people were not quite happy with such an arrangement. How could a recently emancipated black slave now be responsible for calling us to prayer 5 times a day? This was the concern that many had. Such concerns did not grieve the Prophet himself, who in response spoke highly of Bilal's outstanding character, and on many occasions he complimented his beautiful voice. Another emancipated slave, Zayd ibn Haritha, was not only married to Zainab bin Jaysh, who was a very noble and respected woman from the clan of the Quraysh. She was also not a slave, and she was not black either. But that did not deter the Prophet from actually encouraging the marriage between her and Zayd to go ahead, contrary to the circumstances and cultural practices of the Arabs at the time. The Prophet also encouraged Zayd to take leadership of the Muslim army, and he instructed the Muslims to obey Zayd in his command after his passing. The Prophet loved Zayd and adored Zayd as his own son, and in fact raised him in his own household. By giving people of color prominent and respectable positions, not only within society, but within the function of religion itself, the Prophet drew a clear red line through notions of Arab tribalism and racist sentiments which still have been present. Indeed, on occasion, such sentiments manifested themselves amongst the Prophet's followers. One report refers to the incident between Abu Dharr and Bilal himself. Bilal was insulted by Abu Dharr when he called him the son of a black woman. Bilal was understandably upset by this, and he took his complaint to the Prophet and was met with the Prophet with tears. Muhammad subsequently reproached Abu Dharr and angrily asked him, "Do you still possess signs of pre-Islamic ignorance?" Full of remorse, Abu Dharr hurried to find Bilal, and the report stating that he subsequently put his face on the earth and declared that he would not lift his face from the ground until Bilal rubs his foot on top of his head. Bilal did no such thing, and in turn forgave Abu Dharr for what he said to him, and they were thus reconciled. Now, the impact of the Prophet's uncompromising stance on racism and tribal tendencies amongst his followers is reflected in a later statement made by the second caliph and successor to the Prophet, Omar, who once said, "Bilal is our master, and he was emancipated by our master, Abu Bakr." In regards to attitudes towards non-Muslims, the ethos of knowing one another is also embodied. The prophetic model transcends worldly considerations. There was once a coffin that was carried past in front of the Prophet while he was sitting with his companions. Seeing this, Muhammad stood up out of respect. Now some of the companions looked at each other and they said, "O Messenger of God, this man was a Jew." Upon hearing this, the Prophet retorted, "Is this not a human soul?" Another widely reported episode from the Prophet's biography is when the Christians of Najran visited Medina to speak and meet with the Prophet. To the surprise of many, the Prophet hosted the Christians in their own mosque for several days, allowing them to use the mosque itself for their services and prayers. During this time, the Prophet engaged in extensive dialogue with them, debated with them, and was always hospitable to them at every single moment. To take another example, one perhaps more political, we can look at the Charter or Constitution of Medina. This document was reportedly drawn up by the Prophet following his migration from Mecca to Medina and establishes the mutual rights and obligations amongst the various groups that comprise the new Medinan society. Such a document set out to establish a relationship of peaceful coexistence and cooperation between the new Muslim polity and its larger, predominantly Jewish neighbours. And some of the points which were enumerated in the document was security and safety of each member of Medina was secured and guaranteed from external threats. The religious communities were to be given complete and autonomous freedom to practice their religion as they see fit. And the life and property of all who dwell in Medina is considered sacred and inviolable, and it will be protected by law and order. Another condition of the treaty was no signatory party will go forth to battle without the consent and support of the Prophet. So no group within the society was to go out and make any sort of military preparations without the consensus of all parties involved in the signatory, so that they can protect the peace of the city itself. This charter also described the signatories as one political unit, or one ummah, or community, comprising of Muslims and non-Muslims. And the non-Muslims living under a Muslim polity were called dhimmis. And this translates from the Arabic as protected citizen. And there's a famous statement of the Prophet where he says, "Whoever wrongs a dhimmi shall find me, the Prophet, to be their advocate on the Day of Judgment against a Muslim who oppressed a non-Muslim citizen." Moving on, commenting on the prophetic hadith that says, "None of you has achieved faith until he loves for his brother what he loves for himself," the 13th century scholar Imam Nawawi states, "When the Prophet says brother, we should interpret this as universal brotherhood, which includes Muslims and non-Muslims." He continues, "The word love here refers to a desire for good and for benefit to come to others. This love is celestial or spiritual love, however, and not earthly or human love. For human nature causes people to desire to harm, for harm before their enemies, and to discriminate against those who are unlike them in creed, color, or character. As such, mankind must oppose their nature and pray for their Muslim, non-Muslim, and Muslim brothers and sisters, and desire for others what they desire for themselves." Now, returning to the center of our discussion, knowing one another also implies a clear recognition of our differences as well. This would be apparent to all. The Islamic tradition, by and large, has been concerned with using these differences as points of identification, of knowing where one came from, one's tribe, one's family, one's cultural context, but not, as the Quran makes clear, as a point of superiority, because such racial, cultural, and linguistic distinctions are something we have no agency or choice in, but rather it is something ultimately determined by God Himself. Moreover, when we look historically, Islam has not been seen as a culturally predatory religion. There were no forced imposition of the Arabic language, nor any linguistic genocide for that matter, when it encountered other peoples and civilizations, but rather there was an enrichment. Notwithstanding the contribution of Arabic writers, those here familiar with Persian poetry will know very much that it was the Persian language, more so than Arabic, that became the central vehicle of poetic expression of one's love and adoration for the divine, as expressed in the endless list of Persian Sufi poets. Importantly, what was considered sacred that appears to be of Arab origin was due to it being from the person of the Prophet himself, and was loved and cherished by Muslims for his sake, and not for the sake of it being inherently superior because of it originating in modern-day Saudi Arabia. Wherever Islam and its people went, it elegantly wove the ethos of the religion within the fabric of the local and indigenous cultures, and produced some of the most impressive and beautiful intellectual and cultural achievements of the pre-modern world. In the words of Dr. Omar Farouk Abdullah, for centuries, Islamic civilization harmonized indigenous forms of cultural expression with the universal norms of its sacred law. It struck a balance between temporal beauty and ageless truth, and fanned a brilliant peacock's tail over unity and diversity from the heart of China to the shores of the Atlantic. The fact that we have such an incredibly rich, vibrant, and impeccably diverse array of artistic expressions of culture from the Islamic world on display today is a testament to such matters. I've done my best to give you a small taste of what the verse, "so you might come to know each other," has meant historically for the early Muslims, and how that ethos was embodied in the personhood of the Prophet himself. My colleague Muhammad Aksu will now explore such implications of these ideas in the contemporary world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dylan. Don't expect very much from now on academically or anything like that. The intellectual level will drop a little bit, sadly, from now on, now that I've taken up the lecture. But I'd also like to welcome everybody to be here with us. It's a real honour to, and very exciting for us to be together with our friends at the National Museum, and to be able to do different activities and things surrounding the exhibition. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about the period following what Dylan started after the Prophet's time, and more about modern dialogue and how the verse, how the phrase that we've been considering is an important one, and has been quite an important one today in, to some extent, getting Muslims, as a Muslim, I come into this area as a Muslim myself, kind of getting us out of our comfort zones, or getting us out into the community to interact with others and taking part in dialogue that is really, really enriching. So Dylan did set it out quite nicely, and as Muslims, we have a little bit of an issue. We look at the Prophet's time, and we look at it, and the people who lived during the Prophet's time did it really, really well. And then sadly, after that time, a lot of us Muslims, we kind of petered off to some extent. And the 20th and 21st century has been a time of us kind of returning back to that source, reading it in a manner in our current lens, and saying, well, you've got a lot of this, there's a whole bunch of cultural baggage that you've brought into this with you over the past how many centuries. Is this really what was happening? Is this really what was at the essence of everything? So we've kind of reimagined and took another look at ourselves as a people, as community, as a religion as well. So I'm looking at, during the medieval period, when I was researching this, there are a couple of scholars who trace the history of intercultural, interfaith dialogue. And there isn't really too many standout examples of real intercultural or interfaith dialogue happening at this time. You know, things like the Crusades, things like Ottoman expansion, you know, though a lot of the people living in these empires were generally quite okay with each other. Like the Ottoman Empire had a system called the Millet system, which was quite similar to the Medina Charter or constitution that Dylan was speaking about, where people were divided based on their religion, and they were given the ability, a sense of religious autonomy. They had their separate courts. They were judged based on, they had their own judges of their own religious background who would rule in their own cases. And a lot of scholars say that one of the biggest reasons why the Ottoman Empire fell apart was nationalism appeared. And if you've got a system based on religion and everybody's worried about their own nation and wants national autonomy, the empire just, the people of the Ottoman Empire did not know how to deal with this. person got up and said, I'm Arab now, I'm Turk now. Whereas for, 600 years, they were Christian, Muslim, and Jew. So it was really difficult for the system to deal, for the Ottoman Empire to deal with these challenges. But there aren't too many examples of interfaith dialogue happening. I've got two that I just briefly wanted to share with you guys. One was with St. Francis of Assisi during the Crusades. He actually accompanies the crusading army to Egypt. And during the siege of Damietta, St. Francis, who was very much about preaching true Christianity, asked for permission from his commander to go and meet with the Egyptian king of the time, and he was going to preach to the king. That was his plan, to convert him and end the battle through conversion. Well, it didn't really go in the manner that he had planned. They went and they met, and they actually shared a dialogue where they realized that there are many more commonalities with between the two religions, and they both left the interaction as better Christians as better Muslims. And this meeting actually played quite a important role in the end of that battle, and played a role in kind of the end of the Crusades petering off as well. There was a PBS documentary made last year called The Sultan and the Saint. It's based on a book. I would highly recommend it if you're interested in interfaith dialogue, or you want to find out more about that period. It's a wonderful documentary that we screened a couple of weeks ago as Blue Star. It'd be a wonderful thing to watch. Besides that, another example of a medieval or late medieval figure was Akbar the Great, who is a Muslim emperor in India. And he was an interesting guy. He started off quite aggressively expanding his empire, and then I think he got satisfied after a while, and then he sat down and he started having a look at the religions of the people that he actually was interacting with, Hindus, Zoroastrians, etc. And he started having a lot of tolerance for them, and he started passing laws saying that, they can't be harmed or treated in a negative manner or anything like that. And you read some of his things and you start questioning his understanding of Islam and how he acted as a Muslim. So these are two examples of people who were kind of looking for commonalities, interested in trying to find out more about the people that he ruled over and interacted in. The people that I read, Swidler was saying that the appearance of the Enlightenment also played an important role in people understanding themselves and the concepts of rationality, of freedom, because the central tenets of interfaith dialogue are about that respect. And we'll see where I track this to. It's about having respect and tolerance for difference. So that comes with this understanding, these modern concepts of freedom, of reason, which leads into dialogue. And Swidler actually says something very interesting. He says that when the term "all men are created equal" was said in Philadelphia, and he reminds us that Philadelphia means the place of brotherly, sisterly love. He says that there was a soft whisper which said, therefore dialogue. So if we're all created equal, and we all accept this, that none of us, one is not superior than the other in any manner, well then, we need to have a chat, eh? We need to have some kind of interaction and figure out a way to exist with each other if we're all created equal, rather than subjugate and hate and hurt each other. So, one of the first examples of this was in 1893. There was a parliament of the world's religions in Chicago. It was the first where people from different faiths got together and they began this notion of trying to figure out, well, how are we going to kind of exist together? And this respect. Other things that we should keep in mind when we're talking about this, especially with the 20th century, the movement of people, the movement of capital, unprecedented and seen, never seen before in history, would obviously play a role. Access to information, You know, previously a lot of scholars were engaging in polemic debate with each other, whereas sound sources began changing how Christians viewed Muslims, for an example, traditionally, and similarly how Muslims started realizing Christian scholarship and their understandings of each other. So that's a really important point. And it's only by the mid-20th century that we really start seeing some concrete movements towards a modern understanding of dialogue. I want to briefly speak about, I'm going to talk about two religious figures in a little bit of detail who are quite important in the modern notions of dialogue from a Muslim perspective. One of them is a man named Said Nursi, who grew up in the remnants of the late part of the Ottoman Empire and then was part of the modern Turkish Republic. And he, quite early, you know, maybe 15, 20 years after that first parliament, and a lot, quite almost like half a century before the Catholics that we're going to get to, he came together with a whole bunch of Muslims and he did a sermon at a mosque in Damascus where he spoke about what he believed was the problems of the Muslim world at that time and the future. And he was quite influenced by philosophy. And you can imagine, you know, the 19th century being a time when a lot of different philosophies entering parts of the world. If anybody knows Russian history, they'll know, you know, that the Russian czars tried to block as many books as they possibly could at this time because they were worried it was going to lead to revolutions, the philosophy. So he was quite influenced by it. And he said, and he saw that one of the biggest problems was greed and material philosophy. He saw that, and he grew up in difficult times. He grew up seeing a lot of abject poverty, war, destruction that he believed happened because of material greed. And he said that, you know, the problems aren't East or West or Muslim and Christian, rather it's materialist. And he basically had two ideas of Europe, of the West and of modernity. And he said, one, he believed, you know, followed the sciences which served justice and the activities which were beneficial for the life of society. And these got their inspiration from Christianity. From true Christianity is the term that he used. Or the second one was what he believed was dark philosophy of naturalism, which drove humankind to vice and misguidance. And, you know, maybe from our lens more than a century later, we can look back and say, well, you know, that second point might not be all completely true, you know, that it wasn't all bad. But there is some value to what he's saying. If you live in abject poverty and you look at the society around you, he said, well, fellow Christians, true believers, we need to come together as people of faith and we need to try to challenge this. So he saw that the common enemies of Muslims and Christians at this time were poverty, ignorance, and enmity. He was not concerned about religious doctrine and other things like that. He said that these are the fundamental issues that we face. And sometimes when I read Said Nursi and I look at the world that I live in today, and it's still pretty true. You know, three of the biggest fundamental issues that we still have in society today are poverty, which can lead people to do God knows what, ignorance, same, and enmity, hatred that we have towards each other. He never really got a chance to act on any of this. The Ottoman Empire crumbled. He was not very welcome in the new Turkish Republic. He spent most of his life in exile, seen as an enemy of the new Turkish state. And he wrote a lot, but he inspired in many ways an understanding that, you know, there are universal values that people from different religions can come together around and or universal ideals that match with everybody that we can work together with to overcome or to go beyond just our understandings of our faith. He also wrote a letter to the Pope of the time in 1950, and he got a response back. It's really hard to find an English version of it. I really wanted to put it up, but I couldn't come across it. It's generally in Turkish, as they wrote in Turkish at that. He wrote in Turkish at that time. But yeah, he was active in dialogue. The big thing, well, probably the biggest thing, or one of the biggest parts of of this emergence of interfaith dialogue is Nostra Aetate, which it's interesting. It kind of, I don't want to devalue it, but it's almost like, basically, it comes out of after World War II and when the Christians realize, when the Christian people of Europe realize what happened to the Jews in the Holocaust, and they had to come face to face and realize, you know, it was our people who, it were Christian people who, you know, caused this. And so the Holocaust spurred on the church at that time to say, well, we have to evaluate our relationship with non-religions. If we look at them as inferior and we regard ourselves as superior, well, you know, these kinds of things are going to happen again. So it started off as a way to deal, a way that Christianity, the church, is going to deal with Judaism. But it was great to see that there were some Arab Catholic, Maronite and Coptic bishops who said, well, wait, you're doing this for the Jews. Well, there should be a similar understanding for the Muslims, because in the end, you know, these people fundamentally, to some extent, have got a different religion than you. So it began as this statement, and it began as a change in philosophy about how these religions should see each other. And it forced, to some extent, the churches to open up and rethink their attitudes about religions, about communities, etc. And at the same time, it was really important in this aspect that, you know, we have this massive church, this massive tradition, Western church, and how it sees other religions. So I'm going to go back. I just wanted to include this, which was Pope John Paul II was an important champion of early interfaith dialogue. He was very open to it, and if you are able to read his statement, you'll see that he understands the world that he is in the 1980s, and this statement is a really, really profound one. So I'm just going to read from the bottom. Too often in the past, we have opposed each other in polemics and wars. I believe that today God invites us to change old practices. We must respect each other and we must stimulate each other in good works on the path to righteousness. And after Nostra Aetate, lots of different movements started appearing. You know, this could be small, church-based, different community-based, and it began this whole continuum of interfaith and intercultural dialogue. I want to come back to the Muslim perspective and speak about another Turkish scholar who was inspired by Said Nursi, Fethullah Gulen, who currently resides in America. He, during the late 80s and 90s, he kind of goes beyond the step that Said Nursi laid the foundation of only coming together with true believers. He much rather said, no, this should be about universal values, people who share our universal values, no matter if they are atheists or whatever they believe in. We should look for ways to come together with these people. So he regards interfaith cooperation as compulsory for Muslims to support peace, and he sees it as an important part of reconciliation on a world scale based on religious, legal and philosophical foundations. And he's also the inspiration to a worldwide movement called the Hizmet movement, which is quite active in Australia as well. The fall of the Iron Curtain in 1989, the end of the Soviet Republic, was also an important time for Gulen and the understanding of Muslims. There were a lot of places like Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan. These places are regarded as the ancestral homeland of the Turks. And after the Iron Curtain crumbled, many people in Turkey said, well, we need to reach out to these people who were under communist repression for so long. And there was this movement. It began at that time. And at the same time, Fethullah Gulen also tried to break a lot of taboos. Meeting with the head of another faith group's head in Turkish culture at that time was seen as being something that is quite negative. And he was able to do this by visiting local leaders. For those who know Istanbul, very cosmopolitan. You know, the head of the Orthodox Church is based in Istanbul, and still continues to be with, at the same time with Jews as well. He went and met the Pope in 1998, and he had a plan to establish a school, a joint school of divinity in Urfa. Urfa is supposedly the birthplace of Abraham. And Abraham, as you know, we've, a lot of time these religions are called the Abrahamic faiths. The fact that Abraham is common to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It never actually got off the ground. The school never happened. The Vatican really didn't respond in a positive way. But at the same time, in the mid-90s, he came across Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations, the theory, for those who know it, after the crumble of the Soviet Empire. Who is going to stand against the West? Huntington said, well, the next clash is going to be between the Muslim world and the Western world, whereas Fethullah Gulen said, well, it shouldn't be a clash. It should be something that's... it should be a world where civilizations don't clash. That's what he wanted to put forward as his theories. So it's about... And it goes back to what Dylan was saying about back to the verse. You know, it's related to everything in the cosmos. To engage in dialogue with other related beings is therefore part of a person's human nature. So it's not about faith, but about love and serving humanity, about a way to find common grounds to do good things. I'm going to specifically just speak about the verse today and what it means and how it inspires people who are involved, Muslims who are involved in dialogue. And a lot of these ideas would have some kind of role in the naming of this exhibition that we have at the museum now as well. So we look at it at the lens Dylan was talking about, race being an important part of it, but today it's regarded through the lens of diversity. You know, it's seen that diversity, and when taken with other verses in the Quran, it's that diversity in ethnicity, color, and faith and culture was intended. God intended to create us differently from each other so that we have to figure it out in one way or the other. It is a comprehensive affirmation that different groups and individuals are enabled to know each other. This next point at times can be hard as a person who believes in a faith, but it shouldn't be necessarily limited to a faith. You know, we have an ideological worldview, etc. This encourages us, and myself, and I hope that it would encourage, the verse would encourage all of us, that we accept that some individuals and groups do not believe in your faith, however much you may desire them to. You know, we say, why can't we all be the same? We love saying these kinds of things. It's like we want one cure, magical cure to all of our problems. To live with the resulting differences in compassion and acceptance, to be okay with that, to explore each other's faith and religion with respect and in an attempt to understand one another, not to look down, to truly be involved in a dialogue and to truly empathize with each other, to wait patiently until God explains what people have differed about and why. So to understand that means to wait patiently throughout your whole life as a person who is faithful. That, you know, when you pass away, we believe in the day of judgment, and that's when everything is going to be known. So I'm not a Quranic scholar or anything like that, but from what I've understood, knowing each other is not a one-off event. It is a constant, consistent struggle. Oh, I had dinner with, you know, some Jewish people. I know them now. No worries. I'm culturally aware. Everything's amazing. I've got that down. Let me tick that off the thing. I'm going to go visit some Hindus tomorrow, and I'm going to be a little bit more culturally aware. Everything's going to be amazing. I know a little bit more about them. And sometimes even as people involved in dialogue, we kind of like doing that. Yep, I feel good. I went to a seminar this week. You know, I'm celebrating multiculturalism. Well done, Muhammad. You pat yourself on your back. But it shouldn't be about that. It should be It should be your life. It should be your lifestyle. It should be everything to you should be dialogue. It should be that we're constantly interacting and doing things together. So from the Australian perspective, Muslims in the West perspective, guys, we spoke about Turkey, we spoke about Rome. I probably have to say, sadly, 9/11 was probably the thing that kind of spurred Muslims on to some extent, or forced us out of our comfort zones to some extent, forced us to respond to some extent, I must say, you know, if we have to call a spade and tell the truth about this. You know, in the 90s, we were happy, you know, living in our little little suburbs, but, you know, cool, going to the mosque, etc. But things happening on a global scale, though very negative and, you know, horrible things, almost pushed us out into this, having to take part in dialogue more actively. And there are a lot of different things that happen, you know. This dialogue doesn't, it's not really organized, it's organic a lot of the time in Muslim community, people just reaching out to their neighbors, doing things with people in their community, other people doing it quite structured, etc. I took this third sentence from one of the mission statements of one of the organizations. I think it was from Affinity, which is an organization that does dialogue. And they said that this was the reason behind it, to spread awareness, to deal with the curiosity of the greater public, and in response to negative events, and promote education about misconceptions, so dealing with stereotypes. Early examples of this dialogue were things like mosque open days. It's almost been 20 years that mosque open days have continued to be happening. They happened again this year. You know, home encounters, visiting churches, iftar dinners, conferences, international trips, art exhibitions. I like being able to add that one in now, saying that, you know, it's wonderful to see that this is another thing that's happening. And I think recently we started off doing a lot of interfaith, but it's become more intercultural. Like, we shouldn't limit ourselves with people from other faith traditions. It should be about the wider community, pressing issues and things that are important. Next slide. I want to just do a little bit of promotion for something that happens. This is an example of what I call intercultural dialogue, not interfaith dialogue. But every year in Sydney and Melbourne, we've been hosting something called the International Festival of Language and Culture, and we'd love to have you, if you are available on that date, to come past. Basically, it's students from about 30 different countries in the world coming together and singing in their own language, sometimes singing in other languages as well, wearing traditional dress. The idea is that to bring the youth of the world together around the common idea that is celebrating music, celebrating unity, etc. So these are images from past years. I put this hijab girl in because she sang You're the Voice by John Farnham, and I love You're the Voice by John Farnham. So it was a surreal moment when a young Muslim Australian girl sang You're the Voice by John Farnham. But this is an example of a large-scale dialogue event that is currently happening in Australia. So I think last week we had the opening of the exhibition, and Archbishop Prowse spoke about love, and he almost made like a prayer. He said that may we not only know each other, but he said may this lead to us loving each other. And it was uncomfortable to hear, because it's true, but I kind of sat there and said, well, Archbishop, how are we going to do that? How are we going to make each other, you know, how are we going to love each other? But if we do come together with these into these interactions, so as a Muslim, the verse says, you know, we've created you in different tribes so that you may know each other. This is your challenge that you come through and try to make this successful. So I think the thing that we know is that one of the things is that we need to do more. In Yücel quotes, Muslims and Christians need to establish joint institutions and social welfare organizations. I extend this to being people from different cultural or religious backgrounds. It does not necessarily have to be Muslims and Christians, but people need to come together and really lay concrete relationships, not It's nice just to have a dinner and, you know, interact every once in a while. But we need that. We've been doing that for about 15 years now. And it's bore a lot of fruit. It's done a lot of positive things. But the next step really needs to be like the divinity school that Gulen was talking about, where people from different faiths come together and make a school where people who are Jewish, Christian and Muslim can come together and be very comfortable and debate issues and talk and interact and really make a community with each other. So that was all I really had, I think, guys. Ramadan is coming up next month. It's a pretty active time of the year for us. And we do some things like home iftar dinners. We're going to hopefully have a large iftar dinner here. If you're interested in possibly taking part in a dialogue, maybe visiting a Muslim home and having a meal to start off any kind of intercultural or interfaith interaction, please, you can come and speak to me. We can exchange details and I could put you on a list to see if that was something that you'd be interested in, if you wanted to find a little bit more about our organization and the kinds of things that we do. Before I finish, I'd like to thank Heidi, Luke, Shona, Penny, everybody here at the NMA for helping out and being able to host us, and all of you for listening to our ramblings for the past half an hour. So thank you very, very much.
Yeah, thanks for that. Being that there are both Christianity and Islam, Abrahamic religions, a very common beginning, I suppose, in some ways. And I've also understand that, of course, Jesus is an important figure in Christianity. And I understand he's also a prophet a significant prophet in Islam. I don't know much detail about that. But it seems like extraordinarily close connection between two religions that have major figures like that, both major in both religions. I'd like to comment about that and how that might help with the linkages between the two.
Yeah, you're right about that, Muslims regard Jesus as a prophet. And there's actually a chapter in the Quran which is named after the Virgin Mary, and it's called the Mother Mary. And I'd like to say there are so many things that are so common between our religions. I think it was about 2 years ago we did a prayer day with St. Thomas More, I think it is, up near the War Memorial. There's a Catholic church up there, and we did a prayer day, and basically we read some of the sections from the Quran that were regarded as prayers. Our Catholic friends read the Lord's Prayer and sang some hymns, and we kind of just walked away from it saying, wow, you know, I could read that hymn. Like, I was saying Amin at the end of the hymn, and I could say very comfortably, I could say, you know, oh God, please accept that hymn, because that is exactly the kind of supplication or the kind of prayer that I would make. Very, very small. And similarly, when we read passages from the Quran, you could see in the same way that they saw that it was extremely, really, really close in their understanding, in the revelation, and The whole spirit of it is all the same, it seems to me, from my interactions with people from the Christian faith. Do you have anything to say?
I would also like to just add on to what Muhammad was saying, that it's very true that not only in just in terms of Jesus Christ, whom the Quran actually calls the Messiah as well, he's called the Masih in Arabic, which means he's the anointed one of the Messiah. So there are a lot of similarities in terms of Jesus' life that's reported in the Quran and also in the Gospels, the four Gospels in the New Testament. But it's not just limited to Jesus. There are many connections that can be looked at from, like, historically or from just even just like comparatively with the two different religions. For example, if you take the rest of the prophets that are mentioned in the Old Testament, Islam respects Adam, respects Noah, Abraham, and considers these people as the founding fathers of their particular communities. So There are certainly many things that we can look at once we come to learn about each other. And I think that's the main issue of what we're trying to do with Blue Star, is that we don't really know these differences or these similarities until we actually sit down and do what we're doing today and actually coming and discussing and learning about these things. So there's certainly a lot there that can be explored for those who are interested.
So could you just briefly tell us about what the link is between what you've been talking about and this exhibition?
Well, I think probably the biggest thing, and if you look at it from a dialogue perspective, is that, well, there is not that much difference culturally, in a humanitarian way, or from all different aspects that, you know, Muslim society loved art, they were interested in civilization, they had challenges, they respected beauty, they lived very much in a similar manner to what any other civilization or people did. So if visiting the exhibition you have a little bit more appreciation for that art, for the customs and the civilization, I think that would probably be the ultimate goal of the whole thing. If you come away saying, "Wow, Muslims, they enjoy doing art. They, were good builders. They were good weavers. This is important in their tradition." To me, that is a huge success, because sadly, a lot of the time, maybe not really saying this audience here, because the people here seem to be educated, but a lot of people would find it hard to believe that, Muslims or that part of the world were humane or were civilized or were, contributing members of society in their time. It's hard sometimes. Like, as I said, this audience is different, but there are people who truly know so little about our faith and our tradition. So to me, that would be at the most simplest form. I'm not really a art historian to be able to go into much detail about materials and concepts and stuff like that, but even at a simple level, that would be something that's really, really important. Do you have anything to say?
Yeah, no, I'd just like to say that I think that's just going on for what Mohammed was saying. I think that's probably perhaps why we will come here to give the first sort of introduction to the lecture, to sort of unpack the title of the exposition itself, and to really explain what is the meaning of dialogue and coming to know each other. Because that's how we have all this material that we have now, that we can just go outside and explore. We wouldn't know that as a Western culture and a Western civilization, we wouldn't know that unless we had interactions with other people and other cultures, and in this particular case with Muslims. So I think the link here is what we were looking at historically, how that particular idea was looked at more or less in the pre-modern period, which is what I tried to do earlier, and then what Muhammad was trying to cover in the modern era of how Muslims are continuing this tradition of exploring different cultures and civilizations, and how that can contribute to better understandings between not only Muslims but between everybody in society.
Thank you so much, Dylan and Muhammad. That was your knowledge and interest in coming to the museum is so much appreciated. My name's Carol Cooper. I was the lead curator for this exhibition, and I just I found it fascinating during your talk, especially, well, both of your talks, but Mohammed, you mentioned I think it was Said Nursi, I'm not pronouncing that very well, but and his interactions with Pope Pius. But it was Pope Pius XI who in 1925 invited all of the Catholic missions throughout throughout the world, really, to bring to Rome for the International Exposition, or he created an exposition in Rome in 1925, where 100,000 objects were brought to Rome. 100,000, that's an extraordinary number, brought to Rome, were exhibited in Rome, including the Islamic objects that come from Africa and Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and Southeast Asia came to Rome, a lot of them at that time. And 60,000 of them were sent back at the end of the exposition, but 40,000 were retained. And the reason for having that exposition was so that the Pope could reach out and show that, especially at that time in the world when there was a lot of, discord between the two world wars, that people should be valued. All people should be valued, and it's really fascinating. 67 of those objects have come to the museum, come to the museum from the Vatican Anima Mundi Museum. And one of the for anyone that's been in the exhibition yet, you might have noticed them, or those that have still got the opportunity to go, and it is free and open every day, every weekday until, or every day of the week until the 22nd of July. But there's a beautiful pair of embroidered boots, and they're actually mentioned in the one of the accounts that is written at the time of people, of the Pope actually coming to that exhibition and looking through and taking note of the amazing objects. And so those objects are actually with us here at the museum today.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.